Welcome to the forum that we're having. Thank you all for coming. This is Tom Haynes, who is one of our Snowdance winners and, did you say executive producer of the film Gold Fever, which we'll be showing tonight. And he is going to lead a kind of forum discussion, mini presentation, not so much presentation on, you'll do better explaining.
Keeps me motivated. So yeah, first of all, thank you so much for coming. This is it's a beautiful afternoon and people obviously here enjoy being outside, so you could have done a lot of other things. So thanks a lot for being here. Yeah, initially I was thinking that it's before the film, and so I don't necessarily want to be talking about 8 million things in the film, and then as you see it tonight, it does a better job than me blabbing about it, obviously. So I thought, well, what should I blab about with you blabbing back at me? And then I thought, well, maybe expanding on the idea of how global partnerships are, A, the context of the film, and also, I think, can save the U.S. church. That's the new title of this, as opposed to the one that I gave to poor Miranda, to just trying to keep up with my changing my mind. So the title now is Global Partnerships Can Save the U.S. Church. That's what we're going to be talking about today. And yeah, I hope it will be a forum, and I hope that you will ask questions whenever you want to, or chime in whenever you want to, and you have something to say. So I'm going to be telling some things about my own experience, obviously. Otherwise, it would be kind of silly for me to be standing up here. But you also have experiences as well. In fact, I'm wondering, how many of you have been to Guatemala? Or one, two, how many of you have been to anywhere in the global south?
Do you count Mexico?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Okay. So lots of you. And where have you been?
Nicaragua.
Nicaragua? Yeah. And you've been?
Nicaragua,
and I wonder, Palestine's kind of the global south, I don't know.
Yeah.
Israel, not so much, right?
Yeah.
Mexico.
Mexico? Yeah.
Namibia.
Australia.
Yeah, so you've got a lot of experience, and so, Melanie, and so, yes, so you will have some rich material to bring to this. You know, it's interesting, because when we go to another country, it's interesting is in terms of who we are. And that's one of the things that I want us to talk about today is who are we when we're partners to organizations that are not in the United States? Who are we? And Namibia brings up an interesting example of how things can shift when we go to other places. We have a friend who is from Guatemala named Gloria Chinico, who's the daughter of Fidel, who got us connected, who's connected to the film. But her father worked for the Augsburg Center for Global Education in Minnesota, but they're from Guatemala. And so their children have free tuition at Augsburg. And so one by one, they came up from Guatemala to go to school there. And Gloria came up to Guatemala as the poor Mayan girl from Guatemala, the poor brown Mayan girl from Guatemala. And then that wasn't quite enough of a cultural exchange. She actually majored in cultural competency and feminist studies there. And that wasn't quite enough of a cultural shift for her. So she spent time in Namibia and went to Namibia.
That's actually the program that I went through.
So you know her? That
yeah.
Same one?
Well, I don't know that individual, but that was the program.
Oh, that's the program you went through. My goodness, we have these connections all over the place today already. So she went to Namibia, and all of a sudden, she was the rich white girl from the United States, which was quite jarring to her.
And upsetting.
And then she had to start processing. Well, yeah, I was the poor Mayan girl, brown Mayan girl from Guatemala, but now I've just about finished a degree. I mean, I'm getting to be part of the elite class in the United States, let alone Guatemala. And so it's interesting how these things change us and who we are. I'm going to give a little bit more bio type stuff, but this is Diane, who we're married to each other. You may have known her to each other. And Diane's an executive producer on the film also. She wasn't the executive director of the company that owned the film, which is my kind of made up title for it. We needed a nonprofit to do that, so that was part of what I did. But very much involved in the film and very much involved in these adventures. And her expertise is actually immigration reform. And so she is very good at getting people to get on a plane to go to the Mexico-U.S. border. So we do that at least once a year. One time with Vicki Schmidt. That was the first time actually we did that. But I want to start by saying what kind of got me involved in this whole thing of global partnership. And that was the trip that we're talking about with Sister Parish in 1989, when our friend Vicki called and asked us to to consider being a sister parish. And I literally did not know where Guatemala was on the map. I'd been through seminary. I was a Lutheran pastor. But I had no... At seminary, things would happen related to global ministries, and I paid no attention whatsoever. And people, exalted people would come from all over the world, and I didn't think it mattered to me at all. And all of a sudden, I'm trying to find Guatemala on the map. And so we go there, and thought it was also a bright idea to bring our 12-year-old son along. And it was this motley crew that went was a administrative assistant from Pepsi, her husband, who was did body work on cars for a local place there, a nurse, the intern that we had at our parish at the time, and our 12-year-old son and me. And none of us spoke Spanish, and none of us had a clue what we were doing. And it was during the conflict. There was a conflict in Guatemala that lasted for 36 years, and this was in the middle of that conflict. And so we all of a sudden find ourselves in this little village of Chipiapul in the highlands of Guatemala, and supposedly to negotiate some kind of a deal with our new sister parish for 3 years when we would decide how we could help each other. That was my first experience of attempting to deal with what it means to be an international global partner. And I was learning day by day and minute by minute by a very angry trip leader named Vic Fenske, who had left his parish in Maryland to move to one of the poorest communities in Guatemala City, where urine literally ran down the street, because he was furious with when he found out what the United States had done in Guatemala. And I don't know, do you know that story at all? Is that a familiar? Mm-hmm. Some of you, a little bit, yeah. Guatemala reached, they tell us that today too, reached the peak of its democracy in the early 50s. There was a democratically elected president named Jacobo Arbenz, and he was doing some things that were mildly reforming what was happening in Guatemala. So he one thing that got the attention of the multinational corporations that were doing business there, mostly headquartered in the United States, was how's it going with that?
Giving land back to
what?
Giving land back to the people.
Yes, giving land back to the people. And he was going to take it from companies like Chiquita Bananas, United Fruit. And pay them. He wasn't going to take it. He wasn't going to just expropriate it. He was going to pay them the money that they said it was worth on their tax statements, and then give it to peasant farmers. Obviously, they understated the value on their tax statements, but that was his plan.
It had been taken away from them.
Well, yes, by United Fruit and by ARM and all kinds of stuff. So that was that was his plan. Well, United Fruit didn't like that, and United Fruit had some friends in very high places in the Eisenhower administration. The Dulles brothers, one of whom was Allen, was currently the Secretary of State of the United States, and he had been General Counsel to United Fruit, and also his brother, John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles. Allen Dulles had been head of the CIA, and he had also been on the board of United Fruit. And so, before you know it, there was a military coup that was led by the CIA. So we're a little more careful about how we hide what we do. By the way, in case we don't have time for me to do a lot of nuance and give both, I'm giving you my perception of my side of the story. And if you have a different side, by all means chime in. But I don't have time for all 14 sides, so I think we'll just do mine, and then we can talk about the but the other ones as we go through the week.
But so, I would say yours vis-a-vis the people there.
I think it's true. I'm not making it up. Yeah, and my perception is based on what people tell me in Guatemala. And so the CIA basically overthrew the government, and that led to a series of brutal dictators, which eventually led to a rebellion by guerrillas who kind of basically wanted their country back. And that was the war that we were in the middle of when we went to Guatemala for the first time. So we're sitting, our little motley crew, in this church, and they said, yeah, we're going to have a little welcome for you, you folks in the United States, to just welcome you to our village. And about 300 people showed up for this little welcome. And then the speeches started from the Mayan leaders of that community. If you know the history of Guatemala or all of the rest of Latin America, a lot of times the Christians were Christian missionaries came, and they weren't exactly they were persuasive with swords and guns and said, either you're going to be converted or we're going to kill you. But so they brought a lot of their Mayan spirituality into their Roman Catholicism, and these were the catechists and leaders of the community who were standing on this podium and welcoming us. And I was listening to the translated speeches, and I was shocked for a couple of reasons. Number one, I was still reeling from learning what my country had been doing in Guatemala and hearing person after person saying, we don't want your help. We don't even need your help. We want you to leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Quit killing us and quit supporting regimes that kill us. That's what we want. Leave us alone. And I've heard that in several other countries since. So I'm still reeling from that. And then I'm listening to these profound, eloquent, deeply rooted Christian spirituality speeches from elder after elder after elder, grounded in faith, grounded in the love for the earth,
liberation theology kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, and just absolutely eloquent, because they didn't really see that they had a choice other than to live their faith life every single day. I mean, they're being the army was coming to their village. They were facing existential threat. And then I thought to myself, I came to an embarrassing, horrendous conclusion. I thought all poor people were uneducated and not very articulate. That was my assumption. And so I'm hearing people that I know have nothing, and way more articulate and way more spiritually grounded than I am. So that actually has been my experience in country after country after country of hearing our partners in other countries. Who are amazing, who know, I mean, the way they live their lives is just way deeper than mine. That's the only way I can say it. That's my conclusion. And so so I for sure know that it's an incredible privilege to go there, not because I can help them necessarily, although they appreciate our solidarity and our support and their struggle, but also because I have so much to learn from them just in terms of how they live their life. So that is that little piece of it, and I've had a sort of an interesting, I mean, I was an ELCA pastor initially. That was my first career, and then ended up going to law school, and now I'm an assistant county attorney in Minnesota in Carver County outside of Minneapolis, where I deal with data practices. But that's 2 days a week. I've cut that down to 2 days a week, and then the other 3 days, I basically deal with the kind of stuff that we were talking about right now, which is global issues and global partnerships, and specifically what should the role of the U.S. be in terms of those partnerships. And so in that role, I've been to Guatemala, I've been to Honduras, I've been to Sri Lanka, I've been to the Philippines, I've been to Haiti, and I've been to Colombia. So and visited with our global partners in all of those different countries. And they are remarkably similar. The church in Sri Lanka, there are five executives. It's called the Church of the American Ceylon Mission. I wouldn't have named it that personally for all kinds of reasons, but based on a 200-year-old partnership with the United Church of Christ, of which I'm now a member, and of those five executives, denominational executives, three of them have PhDs from universities in North America. So very articulate, and every single partner knows way more about the United States than we in the United States tend to know about them. And as they say, you know, when the United States sneezes, we get pneumonia. So they know our election process. They know who's running. They know how it might benefit them. We see that a little bit with Israel-Palestine. We see reports on what the Prime Minister of Israel is saying about the U.S. election process. We hear a little bit about how Russia might be interested in our elections. That's a subject for another forum. But they are very, very aware. And plus, not only are they aware of what's happening in the United States, they also have a prophetic witness to give to us to the extent that they're willing to hear it. However, we'll get into this a little bit later, but almost all of these relationships that we have with global churches are based on colonialism, aren't they? And based on us sending missionaries to convert the poor heathen in these countries who, for the most part, didn't really need converting. We probably did. But plus, they generally need money. And we have money and they generally don't. And so there's this very, very difficult relationship that makes these global partnerships, they have massive amounts to give, but they also don't necessarily want to offend us because they're not stupid. And they also need funding, which we tend to provide. So that's part of that whole context. So on the local congregational level, I'm a member of what we call our Global Justice Advocacy, and this is Mayflower United Church of Christ in Minneapolis. And our whole entire purpose is to look at United States policies as they affect the people in Latin America, particularly Guatemala, Honduras, Colombia, and then advocate on behalf of changing those policies. because that's part of our commitment that we've made with our global partners there. So that's what we do. That's it. And another group I'm part of is our Conference Global Partnerships team. How many are you? Mostly Lutheran? Yes, Lutheran. Mm-hmm. Anybody not Lutheran?
No.
A couple of people. Okay. Yeah. So Lutherans have synods. The United Church of Christ has conferences, and so I'm part of the Global Partnerships team, and that's where I'm connected to the United Church of Christ in the Philippines through that partnership. And I'm also on the national, it's called the Common Global Ministries Board, which oversees the 270-plus global partnerships that the United Church of Christ and the Disciples of Christ have. So that's what I do in my days that I'm not doing data at the Carver County Attorney's Office. So I think our focus today is really, what does it mean for us to be partners, church partners, with people in other countries? And there are all kinds of other ways to relate to the world, but this is Holden Village, and most of us have some kind of concern about how the church functions also. So what does it mean to be the church in those places? That's really the kind of the subject matter. And they're dealing with issues that affect all of us. And yes, Diana.
I'm wondering if people have a clue if how the Lutheran Church relates to other countries, how the church synod, the whole, you know, the denomination relates. I posed that question because when I was at the Catholic Seminary, I wrote a paper on the nature and mission of the church, and I was Lutheran at the time, and I had been reading a book about Hinduism because I figured my thesis was how should the church relate to Hindus? I didn't know anything about Hinduism. So I'm reading all these books about Hinduism and going, Gabah, they worship the same God we do. I had no clue. And so I went and talked to someone on the synod staff in Minnesota about how does the Lutheran church, what do we do with missionaries? That had been my venue for knowledge of how we related to other countries was through missionaries. And he said, well, yes, we still have missionaries, but we don't tell too many people this because we might not get the support we normally would, but we dialogue with them now. That was in the late 80s, and so there wasn't the sense of we must go convert as much as there was we must go talk together about these things. Is that still the format?
Yeah,
okay. So I just kind of wanted to know how the church was doing it at this point in time.
And I should say also that the reason we're talking about this at all is that this is the context that Gold Fever came out of that you're going to be seeing tonight. So it came out of the global partnership. There wouldn't have been a Gold Fever if it hadn't been for this church partnership with Guatemala. It's not religious film. In fact, it was designed to be non-religious so that other people would watch it. But that's where it came from, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a couple of minutes. But a question I'd like us to ponder for a minute, I'd like your answers to it too, I assume that you've been meditating a lot on the question that George posed in Vespers last night. And do you remember what that question was? He said, instead of getting on airplanes and flying off to other countries, we should use that money and just send that money directly to wherever it is that we're going. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? And it can be broader than that, too. I mean, we could ask that question, maybe instead of getting on an airplane and flying to Holden Village, we should send that money to someplace else. That's for us in the United States who are not in poverty, that's always a good question to ask. So what do you think of George's question? Yeah.
The congregation I came from in Seattle has a relationship with Ilanga School in Tanzania.
Yeah.
And we have asked them that. Because we have helped them with their school and their computer lab, and they said, no, come, we need to have the face-to-face.
And do you know why?
To build relationships, and I think the more we can know one another from wherever we are, the better off we'll all be.
Thanks, Elaine. Anybody have a different perspective on that or a similar one?
Well, so I've been also to Tanzania, and my brother lives there and has for years. And recently I spoke with Mitri Raha, who came to our congregation. He's a pastor, Lutheran pastor in Palestine at Bethlehem Lutheran.
How many of you know who he is?
In the Bright Stars of Bethlehem. And he was saying that it's important for us to come and see their country. You know, they're only allowed, like, there are 1,000 tour guides who are Jewish, and but there are only maybe 40 or 50 who are allowed, sanctioned by the government, who are Palestinian. And so, of course, you get two totally different tours. And so he was saying, it's important for you to come and see for yourself. And so I'm saying it's important for us to go, maybe to be converted, because if you haven't really been there and lived there, and usually it takes more than just, you know, a 3-day week or, you know, a 7-day week. Where was I going with this? When my husband went to Nicaragua during the, you know, Sandinistas, and we were supporting the Contras, and he came back, and this was with educators. They were school teachers, and they went to Faye Esperanza and met Medardo Gomez and stuff. And when he came back and gave his presentation of what our government was doing and what life was like for the Nicaraguans, and people afterwards said, Pastor, is that really true? I mean, they couldn't believe it because of what our media was saying.
Exactly.
And so I think because it is so difficult for people who have not been in a developing country, third world, to really comprehend what it is to not have shoes or to have to walk 10 miles to get your water from the well. You can't, it's really hard to understand. And that people, they just take your land? Really? You know, we can't imagine that happens. And others who, when we visit, they thanked us for coming to be with them, you know. And it was extremely humbling to me to see the hospitality they showed us. And, you know, we almost felt guilty that they were giving us gifts and giving us, you know, big cups of tea when, you know, they have so little. But to understand that we are all brothers and sisters in Christ, and for us to be willing to visit them in their homes, you know, some of them, it was so important to come to them, you know, and to be in their homes. So I have also thought that, oh, we should, you know, not be spending the money on these things. But the more people you kind of convert, the more I think we'll be able to understand others. And to change the mindset and the political attitude in the United States.
And of course, as George pointed out, they're not mutually exclusive. Send my angle and save some. Yeah.
Yeah, we can do both. Yeah.
I think we also have the resources to do projects with countries that help them out. I belong to a UCC church that has had a relationship for years with the Casa Herrera Island that belongs to El Salvador. And just one example, we've done many things over many years, but one example was a Japanese company bought up or took deeds for a lot of beach. And ELAW, which is at the University of Oregon, you may know about ELAW, it's an environmental effort that helps people from around the world. But ELAW found the deeds to that beach land and stopped a Japanese company before they paved the entire beach and built a big hotel. So now the people on Tasahir Island, which is tiny, have an organization that protects turtle eggs that are rare and is able to sustain a living for some people from doing that. But had we not have been around, it would be paved and there'd be a hotel.
Yeah, it matters who's paying attention. And yeah, if you show up with a white face, sometimes that's a good thing. Yeah, Marty.
I have lived in Palestine, and we've been there probably 7 months total, 7-8 months total. And
always people want us to come and to bring others so that we can see the reality of what's going on versus what we hear in our news. There was a conference that was in Jerusalem, and the title was Stuck with the Truth. And so going and learning, you're a changed person, whether it's Guatemala or Palestine or Tanzania, wherever you are, you're a changed person, and you're going to operate differently from then on. You're going to speak differently about this place and these people and what they're going through. So.
And I'm actually reminded of a couple of things. One of them is that the executive for the Global Ministries Organization for the United Church of Christ, I mean, he says, those of us in the United States are always, when we enter into a relationship, we're always thinking about projects, but our partners are always thinking about partnership, relationship. They don't even think about doing something until they get to know you, and find out, you know, who you are. And that's, of course, true in Native American cultures in the United States. So there's a little bit to learn from that. That's not for that. Okay, thank you for that response. And I want to just quickly tell you what my assumption is. Does anybody think the world is in good shape and doesn't need any changing at all? Okay, well, that's one of my assumptions, is that the world needs to be changed. And as you're getting the hint, I think that the church is in a unique position with these partnerships. That's one. It's not the only way, obviously, but we're here and we're connected to the church, most of us, and so it's a way to look at it. I also think that that we're all one world, and that Mayan spirituality, Native American spirituality, has taught me about that. I mean, a profound experience was one time sitting with a Mayan priest who wasn't Christian, and he went on for about 40 minutes about how we're one with the trees, and one with the mountains, and we're one with each other. And we've had the experience in Guatemala where we listened to these gut-wrenching stories of what happened when this man was a boy and listened to paramilitaries murdering his sisters and mother in the village. And then I think we heard this about four times, and someone finally said to him, like four different trips, and someone said, and the murderers live in the village. They were paramilitaries. They were never tried, never convicted, so they're still right there. And we said, how do you live with them? And he said, well, they're one with us too. We're part of them too. They're part of us too. Whoa! I mean, again, that's one of those things I think. I don't know if I could ever get to that stage.
Thank Trump.
What?
Thank Trump.
Well, I'm going to not pay much attention to that. So, my other conclusion is that God is not nearly as interested in nation states as we are. That those borders that we have, the empires have drawn almost exclusively, God is not nearly as interested in those lines as we are. And from God's perspective, human beings are human beings, and it doesn't really matter what citizenship that they have. And so that's been something that's informed my understanding of how we function too. One of the things I thought might be interesting to you is just a couple of experiences that I've had, again, I've already given you some, with Global Partners, because that's what informs my understanding of who we are and haunts me also. And this next one, every time I think about it, it'll haunt me to my dying day, because I'm still trying to figure out how to respond to it. And Diane and I, we were with Wider Church Ministries, so we were representing the United Church of Christ in Haiti. And we're meeting with a man named Patrick Villiers, who's the executive director of 7,000, an organization with 7,000 little congregations all around Haiti. Very politically active, did a lot of stuff that put them at risk. And somebody in our group asked the question, said, "Well, are you personally at risk because of the work that you do?" And he didn't even bat an eye. He said, "We're the church." Exactly, huh? With the church. And then I started thinking, our formative story is Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified for standing up on behalf of the poor to the empire. That's the story we hop over that sometimes. The attendance, at least in our church, is not nearly as good at Good Friday as it is on Easter Sunday. We have to skip that part and go right to the glorious Christ the Lord is risen today. But I don't know if that's a pretty, the Bible, every single version talks a whole lot more about the passion than it does about the resurrection, if you know it. You can count the verses way, way, way more. So, and so, in his view, we're the church, obviously. Obviously we're at personal risk. So then I have to ask myself, what risk am I at? I mean, what's my risk of being a person of faith? What am I risking? And generally I conclude, not a whole heck of a lot. People say, are you afraid to go to Guatemala or Honduras? And well, no, if we think for a second that it's a little bit unsafe, then we think, what our partners are facing, I mean, it just pales in comparison to what they're doing. About. So that haunts me, Patrick Fillier. A year later, during Lent, his 14-year-old son was kidnapped and murdered. A year later. Yeah. Because he's the church. So, many people we know in Honduras and Guatemala, I mean, they all have people that they know who have been killed because they're part of the church. Philippines, 20 people, I think, in the last 3 years from the United Church of Christ in the Philippines have been killed.
And it's of interest that the School of the Americas is a military training place in Georgia where we train people from South America and Central America how to torture and kill and blah, 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 you know.
And that's your ad? Advertisement?
Okay. A year and a half ago, the School of America, who had protests for the past 25 years, we were at that, at Fort Benning, Georgia. At that point, they decided to then, the next year, we voted on it there. What do you think? Should we stay here or should we go to the border? Because at the border, they are now training Border Patrol people at the School of the Americas. Same kind of training that people were getting from Latin America during the Civil Wars. So this past year, the SOA held their resistance there at the wall at Nogales. And to the tune of a lot less people because they didn't get the people from the eastern part of the country going to that. But it was an amazing experience. And because of the heightened stuff that's happening with our current administration regarding immigrants, they're likely going to do it again this year. So you may want to be on high alert for what the School of the Americas dates in October to go to that event. Go to the border. It'll just be 3, 4, 5 days. And I don't know if
it's... And there are events on both sides of the border wall, in Mexico and in the United States, and so you can... So some people from Mexico can't cross the border, obviously, and so you can see them through the fence.
So
the events are right at the border fence, and you can... And so it's a joint event there. Another example I wanted to give you was I was in the Philippines in August and September, and I was curious about their new president, President Duterte. There's been an interesting press about him in the United States, and so I wondered, you know, what does the church think about him? And there's a lot of stuff I could say about that, but it turns out that we were at a national meeting of the bishop. The United Church of Christ in the Philippines is not... The United Church of Christ in the United States only exists in the United States, as opposed to Lutherans and Episcopalians and Methodists who have worldwide connections. So all of the United Church of Christ partners are something other than the United Church of Christ. The United Church of Christ in the Philippines has Methodist roots and Congregationalist roots and a bunch of different stuff. So about 1.5 million people in the Philippines. They just had their meeting of bishops, and the bishops reported to us that they know the president because he used to be the mayor of Davao City, which is in Mindanao in the southern part of the and they knew him personally. And so they asked to meet with him because they were concerned about a group of 3,000 indigenous people who have been driven off their land by a transnational mine. So I'm talking about something that I actually said on the thing that I was supposed to talk about. So they're in this sports stadium living for 1 year, 3,000 indigenous people driven off their land by force that was supported by a transnational mining company and now living in this land. And so
can I just insert the fact that the church is the one supporting them there? you talk about the role of the church in, at this point in time.
They're living in the sports arena.
Yeah.
And they're being supported by a church.
Yeah.
By the UCC Philippines. Yeah.
The Ministry of Christ in the Philippines. But the bishop said they need to go back to their land, their ancestral land. And so he said, okay. He said, I will arrange for that to happen, and I will personally supervise them going back to their land. And before we left the country, they were back in their land. And the bishops were worried that the army was going to be a problem, but he took care of that. And then I was at a there's a United Church of Christ in the Philippines seminary in Manila, and I've been there about a minute, and I was talking to the ex-dean of that seminary, and I was saying, yeah, I'm curious about your new president. And so she went on this litany of lists. She said, well, are you in favor of the poor? Yes. Do you oppose oppression of the poor? Yes. Are you in favor of fighting for Mother Earth and preventing pollution? She had a whole long list. And she said, well, then apparently you agree with the president. So I'm not advocating for President Duterte. I don't know enough about that. But our partners over there are big fans. They're not fans of extrajudicial killings, which is what have been reported in the United States press. And I'm not sure what's happening with those. And I don't have enough knowledge of personal opinion. The UCCP, though, issued a statement. I mean, very, very strongly condemning them. So, it's part of their almost DNA. There are 22 mining sites on the island of Mindanao in the Philippines, and they're very, very active in and they've also done amazing theological research. They did a statement on large-scale mining, saying, calling it mammon, and saying that this is evil, and the companies that are doing this to the environment are evil as well. We don't usually use that kind of language in U.S. statements relative to this, but they do in the Philippines. And so whether it's the right thing to do or not, we can think about that. But it's interesting to see those partners' perspectives and how they deal with similar issues. It's the same issues that we have here. Okay, any responses to any of that? I've been blabbing for a while. This is sort of the main thing I want to say relative to the film tonight and relative to the partnership that the film came out of. We've had a relationship for a while with the Ecumenical Christian Council of Guatemala. And there are Lutheran connections to them too, and I'm not sure what they are. The United Church of Canada is connected to them. They've had prayer services in the cathedral in Guatemala City, where the executive secretary of the Lutheran World Federation was there. So they've got worldwide connections all over the place. And that's our main partner in Guatemala. It consists of most of the mainline Protestant denominations and also the Conference of Roman Catholic Bishops, which in Latin America is pretty rare to have that combination in the same ecumenical organization. So when the executive, the Latin American executive for the United Church of Christ, heard that we were thinking about doing this movie, he said, well, you need to meet with Vitalino Shimolos, who's a Cachacal Mayan, who's the executive director of the Christian Council in Guatemala. I said, okay. And so he said, he's going to be in Tampa when you're there for General Synod, so maybe you can meet with him. I said, okay, happy to do that. And so we sat in this hotel room for 2 hours, and I said, you know, this is what we're thinking of the narrative so far that's coming out of our research in terms of what's going on in Guatemala. And it's very important to us for you to respond to, is this your understanding of what's happening in Guatemala as well? That's question number one. And question number two, would a work like this, would a film like this be supportive of you in your work and in your ministry? And so we spent 2 hours, and mostly I blabbed, but then we had some dialogue, and then he said, yeah, to both questions, absolutely, that's how we understand what's happening in Guatemala, and this would be a very important work and be helpful in our ministry. So based on that, the Interest of Christ, you're going to see the English version of the film tonight. There's also a Spanish version where the people who are speaking in English on the film, including Jack Nelson Palmer, who has a lot to say about the School of the Assassins, by the way, in his book. He's one of the interviewees. So in the Spanish version, all of those, the talking heads in English are in Spanish. And so when the film premiered, in Guatemala City, we sat with Vita Lina Simoloche, and then also solidarity with four of his staff members. So five of the staff members were in the second row of the National Theater of Guatemala. And as opposed to screenings in the United States, and we can talk about this later too, but that was very heavily publicized. It was on the national television, Juan Televisión. It was also in La Prensa Libre, which is the main newspaper in Guatemala City. And 2,000 people showed up from all over the country to that screening. 33 came to Minneapolis at the Minneapolis St. Paul Film Festival, 2,000 people. Mining advocates from all over. And so then all of a sudden we're sitting there thinking, holy crap, this is not fooling around, this is serious. And what if we did get it wrong?
They asked for 100 copies of it to do their training.
I was getting to that, but hang on to that, and if I forget, or you can say it too. So I might say, yeah, what if these 2,000, this is their lives, they are mining resistors, they're from these communities all over the country, they've come to see this film, what if they don't think it's the right story?
Ah!
It's kind of serious. But at the end of the film, and actually I would ask that the credits roll all the way through, and I think you've been doing that for all the films anyway at the end, because it was actually a standing ovation from that 2,000 people for the whole entire credits at the end of the film. And then our sons, the directors, they were invited to come to the stage, and they introduced the people from the village that you'll see that was affected by the multinational gold mine up there in the mountains, and another standing ovation for them. That was a very surreal experience, and we think in my opinion, an excellent expression of solidarity with our international partners, where we're telling the story, they don't know the U.S. piece of it. They know what's happening in Guatemala, they know there's a connection, but we were able to tell that part of it to the Guatemalan audience, and that was an amazing experience. Then, Sant, do you want to talk about what you just said?
Well, I just said that the executive director of the Ecumenical Council said he would like 100 copies to be able to work with all these churches that they work with throughout Guatemala who are resisting mining, and that would help in the training of them. Because of the work that these three women did to resist was a helpful story to be able to tell.
So we did that, and we gave them 100 copies, and so they're using that in their work around Guatemala, which is one of the main parts of their ministry, of the environmental protection. So that's the story there. So, so what does it mean to be a partner? Well, one thing it means, we sang, I was going to say this too. We sang in the song, was that a Vespers also? Yes, God hears the cries of the poor. Remember that? We sang about 10 times. God hears the cries of the poor. Well, if any of us who have been to countries that are in the global south can, I think, realize pretty quickly that the initial audience for the Bible was those folks, right? It's not those of us who are comfortable, it's those people. And it doesn't take long to think, wow, sometimes we have to stand on our head to make some of the passages that are written to the poor relevant to those of us who aren't poor. And we had that experience dramatically. One advent a few years ago, a family always lights the Advent candle, and so we lit the Advent candle and heard the Advent text. The next Sunday, the second Sunday in Advent, we were in Bogota, Colombia, with a congregation that was praying for a 12-year-old who had been raped by a paramilitary and who was about to go up into the up on the river to advocate for this 300 family community whose land was being threatened by paramilitaries who wanted to take it over from African palm oil. And so then hearing those same Advent texts, you know, the John the Baptist and the prophecies and in that context was like, whoa, very, very powerful. What they told us in the Philippines is, when I was there in whenever that was, September, they said, really there are three ways that you can do partnership as we were having our dialogue. They said you can do it the colonial way, which is the way that they experienced initially. And what's that? It's when you use the church to use the people that you're supposedly saving, right? So unfortunately, that's a sad, Latin America is a very sad tale when that happened. Said you can move beyond that, and you can come here to help us. You can do that also. And he said, that's better than colonialism. They said the problem with that is that oftentimes the people who come to help are doing it because they feel better when they're helping. There's nothing wrong with helping people. That's how the world survives. But if our motivation when we visit global partners is that we're coming to be the helpers because we know what they need, that's a problem and it never really turns out well. And in Haiti, people have come down and they want to help, but they want to like paint something or build something. And again, there's nothing wrong with being in solidarity with communities that are building. Habitat for Humanity has great programs where people do that in Latin America. But he says, you know, if I get to sense some people that they aren't really interested in who we are, that they don't really want to know what our story is, and they don't really want to know what's causing us to be where we're at, he says, we have a fence out here, and I just have them paint that for a few days, and they go home. And he said, you know, labor here is like George was saying, $1 to $3 a day. You don't need to have to get on a plane to paint a fence. I mean, we need your solidarity. We don't need that. We don't need you to help in that way. So what's the alternative? The alternative is a partnership of mutuality. And what does that mean? It means that we recognize that we have this incredible advantage when we have church partners, because we have the same narrative that we're doing, don't we? We have the same prophets, we have the same Jesus, we have the same texts, and what do they say? Like all the way through, justice, 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 from the beginning to the end, it's about justice. And so when we're working on the reign of God and working on making the world the way God wants it, then we each have a role to play. And some of that takes money, some of that takes prophecy, we have different gifts to bring to that. So a mutual partnership is a partnership where you talk about that and you figure out, okay, who are we, who are you, and how do we together make the world the way God wants it to be? That's our job. It is to the kingdom of God. We pray for it. Every time we say the Lord's Prayer, thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. That's our main function here on earth. How do we do that? And we have, so that's what, that's really what they want. And they also tell us, and I'm using, these are their words. They say, in order for you to do your job in the United States, and for us to do our job in the Philippines, and for us to be partners together in bringing the kingdom of God, what we need is a shared structural analysis. If we don't understand the problem the same way, we're not going to talk about it the same way, and we're not going to be effective, and we're not even going to be in solidarity because we're going off on different paths. And so they're willing to spend a lot of time saying, you know, how do you understand, and mostly about the Philippines, where we pushed back on them and said, we need your structural analysis also of what's happening in the United States. I mean, they've all been here, they speak fluent English, they've got opinions, and they've got their prophetic witness that they can bring to us. We showed gold fever at our Minnesota conference meeting in Minnesota a couple of years ago, and our Philippine partners were there. And at the end of the film, they actually read sections from their statement on mining that was written for the Philippines and had just been passed by their National General Assembly. So again, another ministry of solidarity from the Philippines to the United States to read that theologically profound statement that was related to an issue that we're dealing with in Minnesota also, which is mining in northern Minnesota. My vision for partnership, I decided that I would be, I'll just read what I wrote a while ago because it says it better than I could rattle off the top of my head. And here's my vision. I'd like to get your responses to this. We work together with our partners to further the reign of God. In Colombia, as in the rest of the world, our partners are sacrificing greatly, even their lives, as they confront injustice. We seek the same end, but we have not been holding up our end of the bargain. Part of our job is to show up in country of our partners once in a while, help provide funding to support shared objectives, and tell their story in the United States. However, if we doubled funds going to the partners, which we should absolutely do, we would still not be holding up our end of the bargain. While our partners appreciate our presence and funds, what they consistently ask of us is something they cannot do. They ask us to seek to change the system that creates injustice in the first place, especially as it relates to U.S. foreign policy and multinational corporations based in North America who exploit people and resources. We in the U.S. are uniquely positioned to do this part of the work we share. As we dedicate ourselves to strengthening this component of our work, we will approach holding up our end of the bargain. We commit ourselves to a shared life in Christ and to an ecumenical global sharing of resources and a prophetic vision of a just and peaceful world order, joining with God's concern for the poor and the oppressed. This commitment will be reflected in common decision-making for mission programs, which will visibly witness to the oneness of mission in and through the Church of Jesus Christ. We will work together to solve problems that affect us all. So that's kind of how I see what global partnership should be about. Do you have any response to that? Debate? Agreement? Disagreement?
Yeah. I think I'm just struck by how unapproachable it is, I guess. Like, here I sit. That seems so far away. And I think it must be like other things that we need to do in our lives and for other people, which is to take the first step. And that once you do that, then you can take the next step and move forward. And if you've never been to Guatemala and don't know how to speak Spanish, you might be able to do it anyway.
Well, and I would suggest to you, after you watch the film, then you can see that it might be helpful in your work. And there's an 80-some minute version of it and a 55-minute version. And there's a study guide that's been prepared by Amnesty International Canada and also one that's been prepared by the United Church of Christ. And you can just turn that sucker on and show it in your home and see what people think, because it's intended to be about, you know, these issues and about our role. So that's one thing we can do. Any other responses? This is why we'd rather do charity, wouldn't we? You can see the results. I mean, if somebody said we need some wealth, and I'm not saying we shouldn't build wealth, but who was it? Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Oh, yeah, good Lutheran, right? He said, yeah, you need to care for the people who are crushed under the wheels of injustice, but you also have to shoot out the spokes. It's a two. And not everybody has to do everything, but everybody has to do something. I didn't make that up, but that's a good line, right? And community organizers are amazingly adept at keeping their followers motivated, and you know what they do? Something. Protest in the street or do something. And does that protest change things? Sometimes, not often, but they do something. So any action is better than no action. Right? I mean, that's it. So, yeah, you can do something. Anything else? Yeah.
It takes some research to find out what we're doing that harms them, you know, and what policies we need, and then how to go about who has the decision making, and you know, how are those how can we affect change?
Is there research?
That you have to figure out, you know, who is the target and what needs to be done to persuade them, you know, if it's somebody who is, or what is the legislation that needs, I mean, so it takes some work to.
It does, this is actually, I mean, one of my agendas, as you figured out by now, is to get the church more involved in that part of it. I mean, there are organizations like Witness of Peace, or like the one I'm involved with, something I could think of. Rights Action is in Guatemala. They have tons of stuff. If you, and I think most people say pick one country and then follow that, because it's very difficult to be trying to follow. I try to follow about four, and that's a full-time job. And just pick one and then find out what's going on there. And a systemic analysis that's really approachable is good old Lutheran Jack Nelson Palmyre's book called School of the Assassins, which is it's the history of the School of the Americas at Fort Benning. But he also, he's been doing this work since about the 80s. I mean, he's
lived in the countries during those civil wars. He lived in El Salvador.
And it's a short little book. It's not a big tome, and it's very easy it does a really good job. And the system hasn't changed. A more detailed analysis is called Drug War Capitalism by a woman named Dawn Paley, and where she kind of does the history of what. There always needs to be some justification for militarizing and oppressing poor people. So either they're communists or they're terrorists, or now they're drug dealers. That's the new one. And that's the excuse. And the response of the United States to the drug war is militarizing the police. And that's the response in the United States in terms of African American communities as well. And so, Aviva Chomsky has written an excellent book about immigration, where she connects the incarceration of African Americans and the Michelle Alexander book called The New Jim Crow with the incarceration of immigrants on the border, massive, I'm a lawyer, almost undoubtedly illegal incarceration of women and children on the border, almost undoubtedly illegal. And she says, you know, we incarcerate black men to keep them out, not unemployed. We incarcerate brown men to keep them employed, so we can continue to exploit them because they, you know, they, we need them, we need their work. So those are ones that, off the top of my head, that are, you know, excellent resources. And as far as action is coming up, like right now, I think, depending on what happens, because Keith Ellison's been busy, but there's a bill in Congress that was introduced, and as far as I know, it's the first bill of its kind that was ever introduced. It's about Honduras. It's called the Berta Cáceres Act. Berta Cáceres is an environmentalist who was shot, assassinated a year ago this coming weekend, because she was protecting the sacred river. She's indigenous in Honduras from a hydroelectric dam that they wanted to do. And so Keith Ellison and a bunch from Minnesota and some other Congress people put together a Berta Cáceres Act, which actually connects the dots and saying we have bases, for crying out loud, in Honduras. We have U.S. military bases in Honduras. That's where the Contra War was fought from. And this is actually an act that does a really good job of telling the story that we should not be doing that, and asking the Congress to say we're not going to fund oppressive regimes, in this case Honduras. But we haven't done that before, so that's kind of a huge breakthrough to actually acknowledge. I don't know, it didn't pass the last time it was introduced, but we're hoping it's going to be reintroduced like any minute. March 2nd or 3rd, I think, is what they're hoping for. It's Congress, so they're fighting about the language, but we're hoping it's going to. So that's an action. See, and you don't even have to just ask your congressperson where they stand on it. Have they ever heard of it? Probably not. And where do they stand? Or give him or her a copy. Yeah.
I'm thinking about your comment, Carol, about, you know, where you start and that kind of thing. I think we all have to come to terms with that. And I've decided for me, and yeah, you have to pick where you feel like God is directing your passion. Because there's so many things that I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the environment. I'm concerned about the way people of color are treated in the United States. And I'm highly concerned about immigration as a result of going to Guatemala all these years and understanding why people are forced out of their countries and come here looking for jobs. So I think finding your passion and studying that and learning about that and seeing where you can plug in is so very important. And, you know, doing the analysis of, and this movie will help connect the dots, which is one of my favorite things about this movie is, and I'll never forget the one guy in there who says, your Congress people are bought. And the first time I saw it, I thought, yeah, you know, that's really true. I thought about that. So that's a big thing to fight, that they're bought because of the lobbyists who put money in their coffers so they get reelected, blah, blah, blah. But if you find one thing that really stirs you, and I think that's the still small voice of God within each one of us, and you work in that area, you learn about that, you know, you pick one thing and do something. Otherwise, I find I go crazy. I sign all these things every day about, you know, I'm objecting to this that Trump's doing. I'm Standing Rock is huge for me. Environmental stuff is huge, but you can't do it all, and it can just drive you nuts. So, just a thought.
We're out of time, I noticed, so... Yeah, thank you so much for coming. This has been fantastic, and I hope to see you all at the movie later on tonight.
Thank you very much.